We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. At the controls this hour, Jason Croft and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In communities all across the country, people are struggling to improve relations between citizens and the police. And the main complaint many people have is that the relationship is tainted by fear and mistrust. What can be done to build trust and respect on both sides? In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with someone who has had a long career in law enforcement. His name is Leon Frazier. He is the president of the Use of Force Research Institute, something that he started after having retired. He spent 27 years as a law enforcement official, 14 of those were as police chiefs in various places, including Central State University, where he was chief of police, Jefferson Township, Ohio, Wilberforce University in Ohio, and his last post was as the chief of police in Tuskegee, Alabama. And before that, he spent a number of years in the Air Force, and he grew up in Alabama, studied sociology at University of Dayton. He was here in our community last week to take part in a series of conversations with citizens here who were very concerned about the issue of community police relations in our communities of Champaign-Urbana. And this culminated in a kind of a town meeting forum that took place last week on Friday that was hosted by the Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. So he's talking with us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him as a guest. And for people who are certainly in the area that want to talk specifically about Champaign-Urbana, perhaps there were some people that had an opportunity to meet him to attend this forum that took place on Friday, some of the other meetings that took place, and would like to call in and talk about the experience, that is certainly welcome. Questions here, in fact, are welcome. Anybody who's welcome to join in the conversation. We just ask people to try to be brief, but anybody who'd like to call in can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, so whichever one works best for you. And people who are listening can certainly also join us by emailing us, and the address there is will-talk, so that is W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, you can join us. And Mr. Frazier, hello.
Hello, sir. How are you this morning?
I am good. Thank you. And yourself?
I am super fine for an old guy.
Well, we appreciate giving us some of your time. I know that as a veteran of many years of police work, you would say, first of all, that the police are very important. It's an important job, and it's also a difficult job. Do you think that today it is more difficult to be a police officer than it was perhaps when you started out, now close to 30 years ago?
No, sir, I believe it's probably the same, because crime has always been there. The police are much better trained today, so to compensate for the difference between now and then, we can probably do our jobs a lot easier today because we have so much training and so many resources in order to get that job accomplished. And I believe that it is, and as you said, a very tough job, and you have to be a very unique person to deal with the job, and you have to have very good supervision within your department to do it right. And if you want it to function the way that it's supposed to, you have to have a good rapport with the community that you're trying to police.
Mm. That may be the most challenging. It's easy to say, but maybe the most challenging thing, having a good rapport with the community that you're trying to police.
Yes, sir, it certainly is, because we have so much diversity in our communities. Our recruitment, let me say that again. I'm kind of hoarse from that Chicago wind yesterday.
Yeah.
But the people have expectations of the police But oftentimes those expectations are not articulated because there's such fear and animosity and such a separation between the police. We've allowed in America a subculture to exist in law enforcement. And law enforcement kind of operate on a us and they situation. They have a doctrine that supports that, that says that ignorance of the law is no excuse. So people never learn what the law is. They don't pay much attention to the constitutional rights that they have but don't know them. And therefore, they don't have a clue as to what police officers are supposed to provide to them. On the second hand, the police gains from the ignorance of the people. They are able to do their job the way that they want to do best to protect one another. When allegations come against them, they have a very strong FOP union now, just about across this nation. So therefore, that us and they divide contributes to a lot of stereotypical views, misunderstandings, fear, intimidation, and oftentimes threat.
Well, you've talked about something, and I don't know that I've ever heard anybody quite put it like this, something that you call the 60-20-20 rule, where you say that you think, on average, you take a police department, something like 60% of the people working in the department are really good people. They're dedicated. You have another 20% that if there's good leadership and good atmosphere will perform well. And then another 20%, you say maybe those people just shouldn't be police officers. How do you get at your right? Is it based on your experience and having observed a lot of police departments over time?
Yes, sir. I've commanded about five police departments. I have trained in, I would imagine, half a dozen police departments across the country. As a matter of fact, in the early 70s, I was in Springfield, Illinois there, and we were teaching conflict management crisis intervention techniques to your state police at Cambridge, Massachusetts, and several other communities. And I have also received training from several different police departments and universities. So therefore, over my long haul, being the kind of police officer I've always been, and that is with a dual dedication to community and law enforcement across that divide, I've been able to see excellent police people. I mean, totally God-fearing, totally dedicated, committed, will put themselves in between a bullet and a citizen. If that bully, if that citizen was nothing but just a wino, those kind of people, you could give them a cruiser, a radio, a gun, and a badge, and just simply charge them with servicing and protecting the public, and they could go out there and get it done. But we have about 20% of the officers who's there, and they are kind of like swinging with the wind. If you have good recruitment, good hiring practices, excellent training, assign them properly, strict supervision, but good, fair supervision, strict discipline, because police officers have to be disciplined to be functional, and retention policy. Well, that 20% will flow over toward that 80%. Now you got a majority department that can go on to really, truly serve and protect the community. But that other 20% bring, in the cases that I've experienced, most of the complaints to the police department. They go out and create most of the harassment in the community. And you can name them. The citizens can name them for you. When you keep hearing Officer Fraser, Officer Fraser, Officer Fraser, Officer Fraser, and all of those references to Officer Fraser are negative, then there's a problem with Officer Fraser. And you need to go and check on Officer Fraser in your police department and straighten Officer Fraser out and or just challenge him to or be gone. And the chiefs of police who's been there, and especially those who go through the ranks, they know who all of the good, bad, and ugly officers are. But ridership in the police department, because of the subculture that exists, and oftentimes have those bad apples stay in that police department, and even the good officers resent them. But through brotherhood, they don't raise a ruckus about them. And if the chief and his administrative staff do not correct them, well, then you have that problem persisted.
Yeah. So I tell you, Mr. Fraser, we don't have a very good connection with you, and I'm afraid that people listening might be having a difficult time understanding you. So I tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to have my guy on the control board, the fellow who made the call, try to put through the call to you again and see if we can get a slightly improved line. So let's do that, and then for the benefit of people who are listening, let me again introduce the guest. Our guest is Leon Fraser. He is someone who has had close to 30 years' experience in law enforcement, and that was after having served a number of years in the Air Force, 27 years in law enforcement, 14 of those as police chiefs in various jurisdictions, including Central State University, Jefferson Township, Ohio, Wilberforce University, and his last post, he served for a number of years as the chief of police of Tuskegee, Alabama. And when he retired, he started something called the Use of Force Research Institute, where he wanted to continue to do work, kind of consulting work, and to help communities who are interested in trying to improve that relationship between police officers and the community. And he was here last week in Champaign-Urbana, spent time meeting with people who are concerned about this very issue, that is, relations between the police and the community here in Champaign-Urbana. And this culminated with a forum that took place on Friday evening and was sponsored by a number of community organizations. Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice also include the local chapter of the NAACP and the Champaign County ACLU and a number of others. We're talking with him this morning by telephone. We couldn't have him on the show when he was here last week, but we're pleased that he could be spending some time talking with us. And certainly, we're happy to hear any sorts of comments, questions people would have here locally. And if people attended this meeting last week on Friday, maybe they might want to tell us about their experiences or their thoughts. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. So we'll get back here again with Mr. Fraser. I've got you there, Mr. Fraser?
Yes, sir. I'm right here.
All right. Very good. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I did when I was getting ready to sit down and talk with you is I just, as a way of starting out, went into my computer and my web browser and just put in the phrase community police relations. You put in anything like that. I think that I got more than 140,000 hits. Clearly, this is a big issue, and all sorts of public policy groups, people who are attached to law enforcement, government, and in cities all across the country, they have some kind of program in place that's designed to try to improve that relationship. And it seems that one of the big things is that they're trying to get more kind of informal contacts between police and citizens, which may either means putting police on bicycles or putting them on foot or just getting them into the community more so it's not just when it's a crisis situation, so that they can build some kind of relationship. And I suppose, generally speaking, this is what's referred to as community policing. And I wonder what you think about that approach. And not, I'm sure you would say, well, that's a good thing, but there must be a difference, some things that you can do that helps that either to really work or some cases where no matter what you do, it's just really not going to work.
Yes, sir. It's certainly going to work when you do it right. And one of the things about putting officers in communities, you have to have a serious consciousness about assigning the right officers to the right areas for the right reasons. You put the wrong officers into the wrong places and you enhance the problem. Now, community policing is one of the best things that ever happened to law enforcement because it puts that off, takes that officer out of that cruiser with air conditioning going, windows up, not hearing much of what's going on around him. And if it was a way you could take cell phone from police officers today, so they couldn't spend half of their time riding around paying attention to the cell phones instead of what's happening out in the community, that would improve the situation. But community policing is absolutely good. I repeat, when you assign the right officers to the right communities for the right reasons.
Well, what? Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean that if you have a black community, and the black community is crime-ridden because black thugs can pull off crime in their own communities a lot better than they could possibly go out into another community, white or Hispanic or whatever, and pull the crime off and get away. So therefore, citizens become up in arms because they are telling the police chief, you don't care about us. You're giving us bad police service. We're not being protected. And the police chief now got to put somebody in their community, in the community policing mode. But if you put an officer there who does not want to be there, if you use it for, say, a discipline assignment, if you put an officer there that is just overly aggressive or racist if he's white, over-aggressive if he's black, and now you have more conflict and more problems that's going to develop than you would have had if you just had to use standard patrolling. But when you choose the officer, number one, who wants to be there, and then not the cowboy, because that's where the action is, teach you how to be the real police. But if you put the right officer there who has compassion, consideration, a desire to be there, and the ability to articulate the language and the purpose to the people there, an officer, for instance, who will stop, get out of his cruiser, walk over to an elderly couple that's sitting on their porch, and just sit on the edge of the porch and talk to them. Well, first of all, they're going to probably be afraid of your approach. But when you, good evening, madam, good evening, sir, how are you all today? Sit down, share some little fun things with them or some serious kinds of greetings with them. Oh, wow, he's, okay, officer such and such. Now they know an officer. So if some thugs come by their house, they can take the card that Officer So-and-so gave them, call the dispatcher to talk to Officer such-and-such. And now you have a rapport going. And that's the same kind of relationship, not necessarily just walking up to the porch, that exists in most affluent white communities where everybody's truly a friend and truly a protector. And the black community is more or less, in most communities that have not put into effect community policing or assigning the right officers, put them on a better footing with their police. So that's what I mean by that. You have to assign the right officers to the right places for the right reasons.
Well, we have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation. Somebody who was listening this morning in Urbana, and that's our line number one.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi. I have two questions for the chief. First of all, the chief not only spoke to a community forum, a couple of community forums, but he also spoke with some local police officers, and I believe all of the major police departments in this area were invited to come to a meeting with him. I would like him to tell us which of those police services responded and sent people there and which didn't, and what conclusions he would draw from that, and anything else about the substance of the conversation that he can relate to us. And secondly, in all of the police forces locally, there are very, very few minority officers. And did that question come up in the discussions with police officers? What's the importance of having minority police officers, and would he have some suggestions as to how the departments can attract more minority police officers? I'll just listen to the response. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, very good question. That was an outstanding meeting. And I was super impressed with the Deputy Chief Cobbs from Urbana and the Chief of, I think it's Rantoul. Rantoul, is that correct?
Rantoul. It's
Rantoul.
Rantoul. Mm-hmm.
And the Deputy Chief from the university. And that was an extremely meaningful conversation and dialogue. And one of the most significant things about that meeting was that we had the leader of one of the organizations there, the organization that invited me there. There had been an arrangement first that I would just meet with the police chiefs and other people alone. But I knew that that wouldn't serve very much purpose because I already know the police language. But I felt that it would be extremely valuable for the leader of the organization to sit there and observe police officers talk with each other, knowing that I was going to draw from police some thinking and some views and some philosophies and some attitudes. And then this leader would better be able to interpret and understand better what goes on among police people. So that part of it was extremely good. Now, when we got into the real nitty-gritty of the dialogue, I was able to talk to them about recruitment and training, hiring practices, and policy development, whether citizens had input into that and et cetera. And what I found was most of their attitudes, like most police officers around this country, most of their, let's say, methods of operations have been institutionalized. So when they go out to recruit, it may be the police department, it may be the human relations department who's doing it, and they're doing it based on status quo procedures and practices and patterns. Well, that's never going to get a significant number of black candidates in an area like Champaign and Urbana because of the differences in attitudes and the cultural subculture, I'll say, that has been developed in the police department. The average black is not going to feel that he can come up into that police department and be respected, accepted, and functional. And I think some of that came out in that meeting that we had because recruitment has been a problem for most of those areas. Now, I found that in that area, Urbana has four black police officers. You have a deputy chief, you got a sergeant, and then you got a couple of patrolmen. Well, the continuity that will bring out the black understanding and the black communications and the black demand that some of what they feel will be accepted is broken because there's nobody between the deputy chief and that sergeant in those other ranks. And then when you get down to that one sergeant, he is scrutinized generally by everybody around him. So he has to be limited in what he can do to mentor properly and to protect properly those black police officers under him. And anybody who says that there's not racism in the police department would have to be stupid, you know, if not insane in this day and time, because you certainly do have a lot of discrimination. You have a lot of racism in most police departments because you're dealing with plain old human beings. And all people bring prejudices to the forefront. So if you have not trained stupidity out of the officers, if you have not trained ignorance out of them, if you have not trained, attitudinal determination out of them and input institutional integrity in them to replace that, well, then you still have things that you got to work with every day. You got to train them every day. Internally, black police officers have to work with white police officers because you got cultural differences there. And the community has to be brought in training situations and in policy development situations to have input as to what they expect from their police department and those kinds of things. So that discussion brought about a lot of police language between me, the so-called outsider, and those local police people that allowed that community leader to sense what goes on up in that culture. And one of the most valuable things that happened in that meeting was, before we left out of that meeting, the deputy chief from the university called upon the leader to articulate his views. And then that was extremely valuable because the leader got a chance to articulate to the police people some of his real and profound feelings and attitudes and expectations from law enforcement. So that added a very significant degree of better understanding there. I ended up finding out that Banner had 4 out of 53 with 7 women. Rantoul had 1 black out of 32 and 2 women. And the university has the police chief, who's a woman, which is very progressive. I had 5 blacks. 62 total, and 10 women. So we look at this and we can see that the university is much better off when it comes to diversity than the other police departments. And I understand from the Rantoul situation, he's out in the suburbs. He's in a little country town. The best he's going to be able to hope for, probably to increase his numbers, will be some of the local guys who go into the military or something and come back home and want to be a part of that little community, because you're not going to get many urban people who want to go out into a little town like that in order to be a part. So the moral of that whole sermon is, yes, we had a very good dialogue. I share with them some methods that we use, and the way that we improved our number of police officers in Dayton, Ohio was, we couldn't do it until we established a Black Police Association. And we just flat out declared war on racism. Black police officers wasn't going to be ignorant and stereotypical, trying to label every white police officer, significant other, or bad. White police officers was not going to be racist in Dayton Police Department to help us to accept it. So when we got in, black police officers started recruiting ourselves. Now, that meant that we did photographs, just lounging around in our uniforms, looking good and professional, and we made posters out of that. We did one poster with black power signs raised by all of the black police officers in that group. It was about 20 of us together. And that got to the minds of black people. We had black guys stopping us on the street, trying to figure out how they could get to be a part of that. And we increased out. I went on in 1965. They had 13. When I went on, they made 14. And by 1973, we had 56 black police officers, because we got out and recruited our way. We got teachers and hired them and brought them into a school and had black candidates come in and take pre-tests, so that they could familiarize themselves with the methods of testing, you know, and how not to leave things blank. Go to the first questions, the questions that you know first, answer them first, and then go back to what you got to struggle with. And that way you'll have a better score on the test and et cetera. So, yes, caller, I did share some of those kinds of things, and they were well received, I believe, that police camaraderie ship and love and trust and respect between those police officers and me was super. And I believe that the community leader was able to pick up on some of that and better qualify himself to brief his organization on where they ought to be in the future in dealing with police officers. And I believe in my heart and soul that it will create a better rapport and understanding and communication between his organization and those police chiefs.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Leon Fraser. He's a man who has 27 years' experience in law enforcement, 14 of those years were as police chiefs in various places. He was chief of police at Central State University, Jefferson Township, Ohio, Wilberforce University in Ohio, and finished up as the police chief in Tuskegee, Alabama. And when he retired, he started the Use of Force Research Institute and continues to travel around to speak about relations between police and community, to try to do consulting work, to advise communities on where they feel that they have a problem and the kind of things that they can do to have a more constructive relationship between the community and the police. And as we mentioned a couple of times, he was here in Champaign-Urbana last week. He did, as the caller said, and as he said, sit down and talk with some representatives of our area police departments here. I met with people here in the community who were concerned about relations between the police and the community. And then there was a big kind of town hall meeting, open forum that took place on Friday. So questions here are certainly welcome. And we have a couple of people who are ready and waiting to go. And others are welcome to call. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We have a toll-free line. Go ahead anywhere you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, well, you can do that too. That's will-talk, so W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And we have some other folks. Next, we'll talk with someone here where we are, Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. I regret I wasn't able to attend your talk here, but I would like for you to comment on some broad strokes about policing in the U.S. We had a scandal here some years ago where the Police Training Institute, which I guess is one of the premier trainers in the state, you know, had secret deals with Blackwater and Triple Canopy, the kind of military contractors and SWAT team experts, et cetera. It seems to me that there's illuminates the possibility that there's a sort of this garrison state mentality in a lot of police, where rather than looking at communities, they're looking at sort of, it's good to have good practice in that kind of thing, but the emphasis that was put on it seems to be out of bounds. And I wanted to mention also the Burge case in Chicago, because I think there's a little bit of a reducing to personal, racial stereotypes and that kind of thing that happens. But there's also evidenced in that case pressure from above, from the DA, to burnish his record, get the cop killers at any cost, even if it means using electric devices. So I wanted you to talk about sort of this broader, what I see as a broader implication. And I'm sorry if that isn't germane to the way you look at things, or whether you can comment on that. I appreciate your effort.
All right.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Training is a very unique thing. When you are maintaining the status quo, and when you are just going from a stereotypical or a status quo kind of attitude with training, but then you have a tendency to go out and get the so-called professionals in this or that or the other. But when you are dealing to try and accomplish the initial mission of law enforcement, bringing it in tune with the community, because I want to preface what I'm going to say with this. When law enforcement is working right, the people are the police and the police are the people. They are so well merged and they're so well communicated. They are just as one. The people are the eyes and ears and the communicators, and the police are the backer-uppers and the supporters and protectors. And you have a good thing going. Now, you have that in most affluent white communities with the police, with the people who are there. But when you look at the other parts of your community, then you bring in the Blackwaters and you bring in the tough SWAT sergeants and all of that, and you just institutionalize those kinds of things. Well, by the time you get out into a community that is poor white or Hispanic or black, now you have a people that already have suspicions about you. They already have fear of you. They already know that you're hooked in as the first link of the criminal justice system that is killing them softly, killing father, grandmama, and killing father, mama, and dad, and everybody else. Every time you snatch their child out of the street for having two little rocks of crack and put them in the penitentiary for 10, 15 years. So you have to go beyond the norm to do stuff to help those people, number one, understand, number two, cooperate, and number three, respect you, because if they don't respect you, they're never going to cooperate with you. And so this group of people needs special training. And I taught the community all around these police departments up there that the police department curriculum ought to include college students, a panel of college students in front of recruits and the in-service training units. They ought to include a bunch of street people, just plain old street people. I don't care what they have done in the past. Set them before that in-service training. Set them before the recruits, especially in the academy, and have them tell the police what they expect. Have them tell the police what they think about them, and have them communicate with. Because when in human beings, once I can talk to you, once I can look at you, and once we can strike an accord, then I can love and respect you. And if I don't get to the love part, I can at least respect you. So that's what we've got to get police chiefs to understand. They've got to go beyond the norm to get the black people. They've got to go beyond the norm to get the Hispanic people. And once you get some respect working for you, and once you become a part of each other, well, then you can certainly communicate and be helpful and protective and service one another.
Well, let me ask you this question just real quick, and again, I have some other callers. Historically, police departments have been organized along paramilitary lines. They're sort of quasi-military in their structure. Is there any other way to do it other than that?
I think you can do it in a combination of ways. You can take some of your guys out of uniform and have them wear blazers in certain situations. Say, if you're going to assign an officer to the school and you assign the right officer to those schools, you can take that officer out of his uniform. And especially if you haven't put forth that determined effort to bridge that gap between your community people. Because it's a danger in taking your police officer out of uniform and just putting him into a school if all of your other officers around that school on that beat is going to act like cowboys. But if you have all of your officers well trained and well assimilated into that area, well, then you could even put the officer in the school with the uniform. It won't make that much difference because of that respect thing. And let me tell you something that I found. We talk about racial profiling. That came up in just about every meeting that I had. And do police officers racially profile? Yes. How do you know Leon Fraser? Well, I know because I was stupid enough to racially profile when I was on Dayton Police Department in Dayton, Ohio, for 14 years. Well, how did you racially profile Leon Fraser? I was born in Sumter County, Alabama. I was treated like an unwanted stepchild and an insignificant other all of my little boy life by racist white people. Not all the white people in my town were racist, but certainly most of them respected that because the good ones would never challenge the bad ones. So the influence came from the bad ones on me. So I messed around and got a police badge. In 1965, and I-75 was going through Dayton, Ohio. And I decided, as an ignorant, trained police person, that every white man that I caught coming through Dayton, Ohio, on I-75, headed north or south, if they were speeding, it was mandatory, you had to post bond if you was from out of town, I was going to take them to jail. And I did that. And I did that for about 2 or 3 months. Until I got religion on the freeway one day. And that came when I stopped a man from Mississippi who was headed north to Michigan. I caught him speeding 70 miles an hour in a 50-mile zone, pulled him over, got out in my cowboy stance, in my stereotypical ignorant state, walked up to this man, and was ready to tell him that he was going downtown to get booked to post bond. When I heard to my right, under my right arm, "How you met the policeman?" And I wanted so bad to be arrogant enough to say, "Hiya, kid." But now I looked over at that little kid. He was about 2 years old. He had some of the biggest, brightest blue eyes I've ever seen in my life. And I tried to ignore him. And I went on back to talk to his father. I'd say, "How you met the policeman again?" And I looked at those big blue eyes again. And I've got religion on I-75 in Dayton, Ohio. And I found myself giving that man from Mississippi his driver's license back, telling him to have a nice vacation. And then I got back into my cruiser, and I realized how stupid I was, and I know that had to have been God saying, for being up there on that freeway in that uniform, supposedly serving and protecting, and I'm up there acting the fool of stereotyping people and trying to get even and vindictive against these people. So if it could happen to me, it happens to others. We'll have that little angel, two-year-old angel, checking them and giving them religion. It's going to take something. So it takes upbringing. It takes a conscious state. It takes training. It takes good supervision, and it takes excellent discipline, no-nonsense discipline, to make sure that police officers learn some sense, behave properly, and serve and protect their community.
Hmm. Well, let's get at least one more caller, maybe two, and we'll go here to line three, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I guess my question is a follow-up to the previous caller in reference to Blackwater. A few years ago, there was a group trying to think of who was involved. There was an activist group in the Chicago suburbs area, some local people, including a representative from the Quaker Church and from an activist group here in Urbana-Champaign, who were opposed to Blackwater giving police training. We felt that training should be by accredited state agencies. And we got a meeting with state representatives, at least one. There was one person, I believe, from the police academy and from the state police. And at the time, the state police seemed to be adamant that they must have the option of going to Blackwater for training in anti-terrorist training. Do you think there's any place for that kind of training from a group like Blackwater?
Yes, sir, under certain circumstances. Simply because the police are faced with everything. And you can move in that cruiser from one point to another, and it's like moving from day to night. You're going in on one point to demand that you help a senior citizen get back into bed, all the way into the California shooting where they are armed with the high-power assault rifles and body armor and that kind of thing. And police officers, being nothing but human beings, if you don't give them nothing but the soft training, well, then when it comes time to get tough in that split second that they have to go from humanistic and nice and gentle to survival, they need that opportunity to flip that switch and switch from one to the other. But the thing that's missing in law enforcement, as far as I'm concerned, is the camaraderie ship is so tough, the condoning each other's behavior is so tough, until officers generally won't challenge each other. And I always taught all of my officers in my department, if you see Officer A going off and you know that he or she is about to make a mistake, then you step in and you tell Officer A, Officer B, "Let me, I got this. you know, it's kind of like being on the baseball court. And the flyer, the pop-up is there. Whoever's going to get that ball is going to have to call it. I got it. That other person got to get off of it because they're going to bump into each other and both of them are going to miss the ball. That's what's missing in law enforcement. But I told all of my officers, if you stand there and if you allow your partner to get off into something that's going to embarrass all of us, then you're going to get disciplined right along with officer such and such. So, yes, there's a place for Blackwater as well as the good stuff.
Well, we just have about 5 minutes here. I want to thank the caller and see if we can get one more. We'll go to Champagne. Here's line number one. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I wanted to return to the question that the first caller on the show asked about who was and who wasn't at the meeting with the local police chief. I found it very troubling that the most notable absence was the Champagne police chief, Artisani, who was the first officer to show up at a scene where an unarmed 15-year-old boy named Kiwan Carrington was eventually shot and killed by Officer Norbit. Chief Finney's first words at the scene was, "Stop or I'll shoot you." He was wearing a shirt that blatantly endorsed racism and genocide of Native Americans. And given that we have such a chief of police who embodies what you might call Chief Fraser, a cowboy attitude, whom the city manager Carter refuses to remove from post, how would you recommend that we try to move forward as a community?
Well, to the chief's on the chief's behalf, there was a chief of police activity in Chicago that a lot of the police chiefs were attending, including the police chief from the university. That's why she had to send her deputy. Now, notably missing, too, was the sheriff of your county there. And this is critical because the sheriff is the top dog in law enforcement. And I understand there was some, confusion about whether he should come or whether I qualified to come in there to tell them anything about their departments or whatever. People just have to be aware. If Champagne Chief wasn't there, this last call is right on target. Why wasn't he there? Well, then I can say he was at this other conference, perhaps. That's what I was told. So you check to confirm that. If he, in fact, was in Chicago at that meeting, then he's excused, you see. But he could have sent a representative. He's got subordinates under him. And if he didn't send nothing but a PR person, that would have been better than no show. So you hold him accountable for that, you know, giving him credit for being at something more significant, but then challenging him on not assigning a subordinate. And if he is not willing to face up to that and satisfy this caller, the people in his community, well, then you report him to your council and you report him to the mayor and city manager. And then when things stack up like that, they'll be better able to choose whether he ought to be the chief or whether he ought not be the chief.
We're almost at the point where we're going to have to stop. I guess something that maybe you can talk for a minute about is... I'm sure that in a lot of police departments, the way that they measure the performance of officers is that they look at things like arrests. They look at things like how many tickets are written. And that's exactly what I expect you to say, that that it's not just about arresting people. It's about peacekeeping, but that's the much more difficult kind of thing to do, and it's also, I'm sure, more difficult to assess whether and how police officers are doing that. How do you do that?
Well, you establish a rapport with your people. Let me read you the Bible of policing. It's a 9 factors, and I can only give you about 2 because we don't have enough time. The 9 principles of policing by Sir Robert Peel, the grandfather of policing. Number one, the basic mission for which the police exist is to prevent crime and disorder. Number two, the ability of the police to perform their duties is dependent upon public approval of police action. Now, when you establish those reports, you can get it. Now, here's what you just spoke to, and I support it with the grandfather's philosophy. The test of police efficiency is the absence of crime and disorder, not the visible evidence of police action in dealing with it.
Well, we're just about at the point where we have to finish, and we've used our time. I don't know if there's any last sort of thought you might like to leave with folks. Certainly, we have not said the last word on this issue, and it's something I know people in this community are going to continue to talk about quite a lot.
Well, my last word is my disclaimer. I love the police, and I love the people. So my thing is always going to be truth as I see it, straight down the middle, come what may, on attitude and feelings.
Well, our guest this morning, Leon Frazier, is president of the Use of Force Research Institute. He's a retired police veteran, 27 years experience as a law enforcement official, 14 of those were as police chiefs in various places, including his last job was as the chief of police of Tuskegee, Alabama. He was here talking with people about these issues in our community last week. And Chief Frazier, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Yes, sir. You're quite welcome. And thank you for the opportunity.